The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Atta Gatta's true meaning. I can stand 25 feet above the floor on a little piece of plastic the size of my big toe and not be afraid. But this is something that I've worked up to. My partner Kayshen and I have been going to a climbing gym. We started early this spring, and it's in Long Island City, and if you've never been in an indoor climbing gym before, it's this enormous room with walls 45 feet tall, and the walls are uneven. There's great slabs that lean back or hang out into the room over you. There's corners that jut out or fold in, and the root setters who configure the climbing gym are continuously putting up roots on these walls made of these colored plastic holds that are all different shapes and sizes and textures. And so there might be a root up one section of wall that's all consists of green handholds and footholds. And that might last for a little while, and then they'll unscrew all of the holds and put in a new root with different holds there. One of my favorite experiences so far at the gym was the first time that I climbed a particular yellow root. It was rated 5.9, which is, on the scale of things, sort of not very hard, like sort of a medium amateur grade of difficulty. But it was the tallest and the most difficult climb that I had attempted so far. And the way the climb started was about 25 feet of vertical wall with these plastic hand and footholds. And when you that part of the section is not that bad. Like, some of the holds only have one good side that you can hold on to, so you have to kind of lean your body over to the other side in order to be able to hang off of them with your fingers wrapped around them. But that was okay. I'd been climbing a couple of months. I knew how to handle that. It just kind of, like, tired me out a little bit by the time I'd reached the 25-foot mark. Then things got really dicey, because there's, at the 25-foot mark, a chunk of wall that comes straight out horizontally into the room. So picture, like, what it would take to climb up the side of a house. You go up the vertical wall on the side of the house, and then when you reach the point where the roof meets the wall, the roof hangs out over the wall, and you have to climb up into the eave and then reach out over the gutter, and then, like, swing one leg up over the gutter, right, and then the other, and then you can stand up on the roof. So that's what this wall was designed like, except it was the size of, like, a five-story house. So when you get up to that 25-foot mark, you reach the roof, it's hanging out over you, and you've got to, for a few moves, crawl up under that roof, hanging with your body horizontal, hanging by your fingers and your toes, and crawl backwards to the lip of the roof in order to reach up over the edge of the roof onto the next section of wall that's above it. So you get one hand over, and you find your handhold there. Your feet are still under the roof, but one hand's above it. and then you get your other hand over the lip. And so far, so good. But then the really scary part comes when you have to swing one leg up over that lip and make that transition where instead of pressing your foot into this kind of stalactite that's hanging down from the roof, you have to swing it up over and way out to the side and place it on this tiny little yellow piece of plastic that claims to be a foothold, but it's the size of a thimble. And it's right on the lip. So below this little yellow plastic thimble is 25 feet of thin air. You have to place your foot on top of it and then really step on it, like shift your weight over onto that little thimble and stand up and trust that it will protect you from falling 25 feet through the void. And the first time I tried this, I was just so afraid and shaking so bad that I couldn't do it. And it fell off. And it was completely safe because I'm attached to a rope and the top of the rope is attached to the top of the wall. And the other end of the rope is attached to Cation, who's standing on the floor below me and keeping this rope ratcheted tight. So when I fell about a foot. And then Cation gently lowered me the rest of the way. So it's completely safe, but try telling that to your body. Your body will take that information with a grain of salt. The next time I tried it, I managed to get my weight onto that thimble and stand up. But by that point, I'd been like gripping the hold so hard out of fear that they had completely exhausted and my hands gave and I fell off again. So I came back a few days later and I got my foot on the thimble and I stood up on it and I managed to make the next few moves and climb the remaining 20 feet to the top of the wall. And that was so exciting. That was such a moment of pride for me. Like, I was laughing when I was lowering down on the rope. I was so excited. And my hands were tired, and like, I needed help to undo the rope around my waist, but I'd done it. And for the next few weeks, every time we would go back to the gym, I would save time at the end to do that same yellow 5-9 route again. And I got better and better at it, and I got less and less afraid. And it was like this sort of pride spigot that I could keep going back to for more. Every time I wanted to feel good about myself, no matter what had happened previously in the session that day, even if I'd fallen off every single route that I'd tried, I would make sure that I did that one at the end so I could walk away feeling good about myself. And then one day we went to visit the gym and the root was gone. The root setters had reset that whole section of wall. They had unscrewed all of the holes from the wall and put up new roots. There was something purple there that was much harder, and I had to start over from scratch figuring out how to climb that route now. And that ability that I had achieved for myself was suddenly irrelevant. Like, the fact that I could climb that particular yellow 5-9 turned into a memory and began to vanish. Like, I was a better climber than I had been before, but my ability to climb that route was suddenly meaningless. And this is what happens to all our achievements, right? Sooner or later, if we try to make them part of our identity, I am somebody who can do this, it vanishes, turns into just a memory and then a ghost and disappears. Things that I've achieved at past jobs, like computer code that I wrote, those companies went under, the code was lost, nobody remembers what I did, it's gone. Things I achieved as a teenager, like being cool for a second, I no longer care about. I worked so hard for it, and it's not an achievement at all, because my values changed. So think maybe of something that you're proud of that's vanished in some way. How do you deal with that? What does your identity do in response when something that you had amoeba-like tried to wrap your identity around and hold, and then it just turns out to be a puff of smoke and it's gone? How do we deal with that? My identity, it's kind of like a wall that I build up around myself to try to give myself a sense of solidity and reliability that I'm a thing and I know what I'm going to be like tomorrow because I built this structure around myself today. And the bricks in this wall that define my edges, they're built out of the achievements that I'm proud of. They're also built out of things that I'm ashamed of. I think that those bricks are actually much better building material. The stuff that I'm ashamed of defines me. I use the things that I believe that I can do and the things that I believe that I cannot do as bricks in these walls. Things that I believe are true, things I refuse to believe, things I like or don't like, the goals that I have. All of these are these bricks that keep me solid. And Buddha taught, this is one of the earliest, most reliable things that we believe that he actually said. Buddha taught that this sense that we have that we are things that last, that are the same tomorrow as they are today, that we have this identity, it's false. It's a delusion. And it leads to disappointment because we think that we are a thing which we can add good things to and reject bad things from. We can get more of the stuff that we like, and we can remove the things that we don't like, and so the thing of myself will be better tomorrow. And then none of this lasts at all. And so it's disappointing. And this leaves us permanently dissatisfied and stressed out, unhappy with our lives. In the Satipatthana Sutra, Buddha taught a meditation to remind us that our bodies won't last. So imagine a fit, beautiful, Peloton-trained body, and then imagine that it's a corpse. It's blue, swollen, and festering. And then it's being eaten by crows, hawks, vultures, dogs, jackals, or by different kinds of worms. Then it's a skeleton held together with some flesh and blood and tendons. And then it's just a blood-smeared skeleton with all the flesh gone, but it's still held together by tendons. Then it's a skeleton that is held still together by tendons, but without flesh and not anymore smeared with blood. And then it's just loose bones scattered in all the directions. And then it's bones bleached white like a conch shell. And then it's just a bunch of old bones heaped together. And finally, it's dust, bone dust. And remember that this body will become a corpse like this, inevitably. And so don't rely on it to be happy. And I actually personally feel reasonably at peace knowing that this body will be a corpse. I actually sort of like aging, at least right now. But I think it's sort of miraculous that my beard is a little bit grayer every month. I even sort of like the aches and pains, the way that the shape of my face is changing. It feels as miraculous as like the first snow, evidence that seasons still change. It's like this natural phenomenon is going, and that feels amazing, especially when it's happening to me. But I think that the fundamental disappointment of our lives is not that our bodies are temporary, but rather that the stories we tell about who we are temporary. We want to construct a story that proves that we are who we think we are, and then it just turns out to be false, and it fails us. It's especially true of the stories that we tell about our Zen practice. Maybe on some long retreat you had some experience that was really intense. Or maybe you spent some period with your mind in a state that was peaceful and joyous. Maybe you stopped worrying, or maybe you stopped thinking for a while once. And that was exciting, and you thought, I'm going to always be like this, or I've had a breakthrough or an insight that's going to make it possible for me to always return to this state. And then you return to your regular life, and you go back to your old habits once again. And all of the same anxieties and thought patterns resume. And it's incredibly frustrating. I think among all of the achievements that I've had to forget about and abandon, the Zen achievements are some of the shortest lived of all. Even the sort of negative achievements in a way, like I once did a retreat where I was so anxious about my life that it felt like my whole torso was going to burn up. And I thought, like, well, at least something is happening. I'm not daydreaming. I am burning up with anxiety. This is a breakthrough. From now on, my meditation is going to be this intense. And it wasn't. We try against all odds to hold on to that story, that this Zen experience defines who we are, that we're making progress. But just the same way that this body will become a corpse and dissolve into dust, it's the same with all of our Zen experiences. It's gone, and it leaves behind a story that we tell ourselves, and the story becomes a memory, then the memory becomes a ghost, and it packs up its white sheet and it's gone. So what if we approach our Zen practice without telling any story about it at all? All we would do would be to surrender to the experience of this moment without analyzing it, without relating it to before or after, without relating it to myself. And then this moment, and then this one. I think it would sort of be like stepping out into thin air. It would be dizzying, right? It wouldn't be hard, but it would be terrifying. Zen teachers have used the phrase that it's like stepping off the top of a 100-foot pole. In the Mumenkan, Master Sekiso said, "From the top of a 100-foot pole, how do you step forward?" And then Master Chosa says it a little bit differently. "Someone sitting at the top of a 100-foot pole, even if she has attained it, has not yet been truly enlightened. She must step forward from the top of the 100-foot pole and manifest her body in the 10 directions." Whatever nice Zen experience you've had recently, it's sad, but you have to let it go. Because telling a story about it isn't going to preserve it. You know, it'll make a story, but it won't preserve it. You have to keep jumping out into this thin air over and over again. It's not difficult to do this. I think that there's kind of a misperception about the work of dissolving the ego that's come about because of some of the metaphors that we use. Buddha called the ego a house with a strong ridgepole. And when he had his great enlightenment experience, he said that the ridgepole had been broken. House builder, you will build the house no more. Trungpa Rinpoche described the ego as a prison with a locked door. I was describing it just now as a brick wall. But the self is not solid at all. It's like just a tissue. It's so weightless. It's so delicate. It flits around. When you're doing the dishes, the self flits into the tips of your fingers and the soap and the dish so you don't drop it. You're not thinking about I'm rich or I'm poor or I'm a Democrat or a Republican or this is how my childhood affected me or this is what I've achieved in the past, right? The sense that the ego is some structure that you have to take apart can't be so because it's gone the second that you do anything with your full attention. It only comes back when you start building it again. Whenever you're doing what you're an expert in, the self flicks into the shape that it needs to be and the place that it needs to be for that activity to happen. Like when we chant, we are mouths and lungs. We aren't thinking about our pinkies. We aren't calling ourselves names. Like, I don't say, I am Jiryu and I am chanting. It's just, sentient beings are numberless. You know? Any skillful activity at all is the activity of the self inhabiting the place and the thing that it needs to inhabit. So try to notice that. When we chant in a few minutes, you're going to defeat yourself because the second you think about it, you can't do it. But try to see as you move around in your life the way that the self changes shape, how weightless it is, how flexible it is, and how when we want to act smoothly and skillfully without a lot of effort, we use the self as a tool. We send it, you know? Send it into my feet when I'm running, or I send it into another person when I am practicing empathy. This happens all the time for all of us. It's not some special Zen thing. There's a story about a teacher named Zuigan. Every morning, Zuigan got up and he called to himself, "Master." And then he answered himself, "Yes, yes." And Mumon commented on this thing that Zuigan did. Muman said, he is opening a puppet show. He uses one mask to call master and another that answers master. And the self is just like this. You know, it's weightless, it's elastic, it shifts, it moves. So here's the riddle. Who opens that puppet show? Who puts on one mask and then the other? Keshin sitting there. Is the wearing of a mask. Who's wearing it? Who's sitting there? Muman says that some Zen students do not realize the true person in the mask because they just see the ego. Ego is the seed of birth and death, and foolish people call it the true person. The true person who is the one wearing all the masks, who's working all the puppets, the one who's everywhere. That's who we are. And I think that watching the way that the self shifts and moves allows us to see the unchanging field in which these actions are happening. And that brings us back to that 100-foot pole. You climbed to the top of it. You accomplished that goal. What's that really worth to the one who wears the masks? That yellow 5.9 climbing route that I once mastered, it's gone. How could I possibly hold on to that achievement? And if once upon a time I learned how to put my foot on a tiny thimble 25 feet up and not be afraid, what's that worth now? It's gone. Master Chosa said, someone sitting at the top of a 100-foot pole, even if she has attained it, has not yet been truly enlightened. She must step forward from the top of the 100-foot pole and manifest her whole body in the 10 directions. Manifesting in those 10 directions, that is being the one who wears the masks, the one who is in all the places. As the self flits from shape to shape, activity to activity, the true self is the one who is always in all of those places, all of those shapes. And it sounds really like lofty and special, but it isn't. It's truly ordinary life. It's the life that's left over when we stop telling a story about the life that we think that we're living. It's the life that we have when, with our full attention, we just really wash the dishes, with ourself just in our fingers, or when we really chant with ourself just in our mouths and lungs. Muman said that if you can really step forward from the 100-foot pole and turn back, that is, if you can return to your everyday life and live as an ordinary person, then every movement of your hand and foot will create a new breeze. No matter what you may do, you cannot help but develop your working of the truth.